Here, the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit from this honorable court.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. This is Joseph Williams versus the warden of the Georgia Department of Corrections. Marsha Witter is here for the appellant, Williams. Sabrina Graham is here for the warden. And Ms. Witter, you may make your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's Marcia, by the way. Just to be complicated. May it please the court. Notice and an opportunity to be heard are fundamental components of due process, which undergird the federal rules of civil procedure and the rules governing habeas cases. Yet, on the eve of merits briefing in this case, the district court gutted Mr. Williams' ineffective assistance of counsel claim and several other claims by striking 40 of the 61 ineffective assistance subclaims as insufficiently pled without providing either notice or an opportunity to be heard. The court did not warn Mr. Williams in advance that so many of his claims were at risk of being dismissed, and it gave Mr. Williams virtually no opportunity to defend the adequacy of his pleadings or to cure any deficiencies, either before or after the deprivation, denying Mr. Williams's reconsideration motion under an incorrect standard and rejecting his efforts to amend his pleadings. The remedy we seek is a remand to the district court to allow amendment of the challenge pleadings and the district court's consideration of Mr. Williams' full ineffective assistance claim, including its cumulative assessment of prejudice, as Strickland requires, Brady.
Let me ask you this question. I wonder if you can tell us about the scheduling order. There was a scheduling order, which apparently he requested himself to give him an opportunity to obtain facts in support of his petition. And the scheduling order specifically stated that the court would make procedural determinations on the claims after the parties briefed them. So when it came time under the scheduling order to brief which claims should be heard on the merits, the warden argued that the claims were insufficiently pled. And why wasn't he free then to file leave to amend at any time during the period of time that he had to address the procedural irregularities in his petition?
Well, let me address that in a few parts. Excuse me, I'm bumping into the microphone. Mr. Williams, the warden requested a single huge brief to address all issues in the case, I think 90 days after the case was filed, I mean, or 90 days from the date of the scheduling order. Mr. Williams countered that, asking for a scheduling order that permitted the development of facts and discovery and an evidentiary hearing request before addressing procedural default issues. The procedural default issues themselves specified that the court would consider procedural default, not the sufficiency of pleadings, but default, cause and prejudice, and miscarriage of justice issues. And over the course of the next several years, the parties litigated Mr. Williams' motion for discovery. He was granted some discovery, pursuant to which he discovered a Brady violation, which he then sought further discovery to augment, but was denied further discovery. And he filed a Martinez claim asking for an evidentiary hearing on that, and the court appointed supplemental counsel to address the Martinez issue before denying it on the grounds that Martinez does not apply in Georgia because Georgia defendants.
So the problems that the court had with his petition were addressed in the warden's brief, right?
I beg your pardon?
The warden's brief in response to the scheduling order. The problems with his petition were addressed in that brief.
Oh, Your Honor, that's not the case. The warden raised several issues challenging a variety of claims. Many of those the district court rejected. It found that the respondent had waived any exhaustion issues by his earlier answer and response.
You agree, though, at least as to five of the claims that are in our certificate of appealability, that the warden did raise those in the briefing that Judge Wilson's talking about.
Correct,
Your Honor. And your client had an opportunity to respond to those, at least as to those five. You agree?
Correct, Your Honor. The warden challenged 10 of the 61 subclaims. The district court We filed a brief arguing that the claims that the warden attacked were consistent with briefing in the past and were consistent with briefing throughout the petition, and so it was not clear how it was those claims were deficient versus any other claims. The district court judge agreed that 5 of those 10 claims were insufficiently pled, but then it struck an additional 35 ineffective assistance subclaims as insufficiently pled, for which it gave no notice.
I want to ask this question. Imagine for the moment that your client, pro se, not represented, filed a 2254 petition form, stating solely, my attorney was ineffective, I want a new trial, period, and filed that. And the district court does a pre-screening review, finds that it's insufficiently pled under Rule 2C of the habeas rules, does a pre-screening review under Rule 4, and dismisses. Is there a due process problem with what I just stated?
There is, Your Honor. The habeas rules have been amended since AEDPA was enacted, and it now provides in Rule 2 that a district court should accept deficient pleadings and allow the petitioner to amend his pleadings and cure the defects because of the severity of the harm that can be caused by virtue of not being able to raise the claims in the future.
Don't the rules specifically state, I'm not sure that's exactly accurate, but don't the rules, Rule 4 specifically states that if it's plainly clear from the face of the petition that it must, the word must is used, be dismissed? Doesn't Rule 4 state that?
Well, this court has plainly ruled, has held that Rules 2 and 3 were amended, such that under the current Rule 3, the clerk of court is required to file a petition even though it may otherwise fail to comply.
Counsel, Rule 4, I'm reading from it. I have it right in front of me. It states, correct me if I'm wrong, if it plainly appears from the petition and any attached exhibits that the petitioner is not entitled to relief in the district court, the judge must dismiss the petition and direct the clerk to notify the petitioner. Correct?
I believe that's what it says. I don't have it in front of me.
So I guess my question is, if the district court follows that procedure under the hypothetical that does not exist in this case, but the hypothetical that I laid out, is that a due process problem?
If it prevents the petitioner from correcting his...
So we haven't gotten there. I haven't gotten there yet. That's the amendment part of it. I'm only asking on the dismissal part of it. Is filing an order which says dismissed...
But, Your Honor, I think those are integrally connected. Because
they're not. Not by our question. So I know you want to link it that way, and we'll get there, and I want to get there with you. But I'm asking, the first part of our COA is the first part of it. Is the dismissal itself, under the hypothetical I gave you, a due process violation?
I think due process requires a contemplation of all the circumstances, and you're not letting me contemplate the circumstances, so it's impossible for me to answer that.
Well, let's contemplate them under the hypothetical I gave you. So we've said in Borden, but the rule itself states that both the rule requires a statement of facts in support of a petition. The petition itself, the form petition, including the one here, cautions explicitly that if it's not done this way, and that facts must be alleged, and if it's not, there is a dismissal. Rule 4 states that there is going to be dismissal as a consequence for failing to comply with the rules. Is that not notice, and is it not the opportunity to meet that notice when someone, knowing what the rules are, files a petition and decides to do it not complying?
But that is not what happened in this case, Your Honor.
I agree. I'm asking if the hypothetical I gave you is a due process violation.
Research the hypothetical you gave me because it's not the facts of this case. And so therefore I recognize that Rule 4 says what it says, and I'm sure I would come back with a different argument with you if those were the facts of my case.
There's not an argument. I'm merely asking a question here. And I understand you haven't researched it, but to the best of your knowledge as an experienced attorney, is the hypothetical I gave you, given that you know the rules, a petitioner knows the rules, knows the consequences, has an opportunity to comply, is that not...
I don't think it's sufficient notice.
You don't think that's sufficient notice? Even what we said, despite what we said in Borden?
Foreman versus Davis, is that the correct?
Foreman versus Davis is the 1950s and 60s pleading, a Rule 8 pleading standard. But that goes to notice pleading, not fact pleading.
It goes to due process, Your Honor, and whether the petitioner or the complainant has an opportunity to present his case, which is the goal of the federal rules. And in this case, it's debatable whether the district court was correct on all of its conclusions about whether we adequately pled all of the claims that it dismissed. But regardless, it dismissed numerous important claims, most of which the respondent had already admitted were properly before the court.
Assume with me for the moment that my hypothetical is not a due process violation. In other words, a court is permitted, pursuant to the rules and our own case law, to prescreen and dismiss, given that there's notice of the rules. How, if the court does that 7 years later, the same exact thing, how is that also a due process violation?
How is that? What?
How could that also be a due process violation? Assuming I'm telling you, as a matter of my hypothetical, that the one I gave you is not a due process violation, how, if the court postpones that decision because it reads the scheduling order to postpone it until there's procedural default briefing, is that kind of review and screening of due process violation?
This court and the Supreme Court have clearly held that it's a fundamental requirement of due process to be provided notice and an opportunity to be heard. And the opportunity to be heard doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists because a court provides specific notice of what its intended actions are and then allows the petitioner an opportunity to respond to those.
Let me ask complaints. It to you this way. Is what you're saying that maybe it doesn't matter whether there's an opportunity to be heard and notice before the initial dismissal? As long as there's an opportunity to be heard and notice before the judgment is entered. In other words, let's say that we had what happened here, but that Mr. Williams filed the motion to amend, which he filed, and the district court then said, okay, I'm going to evaluate it under the standards of Rule 15A, right? In that case, you would have notice and an opportunity to be heard. It might not be in the same order, right? But you'd have notice and an opportunity to be heard. So I guess my question for you is, first of all, are you making that argument? Are you making the argument that it doesn't matter from a form point of view when you get the notice and opportunity to be heard, as long as it is a notice and opportunity to be heard? Or are you arguing instead that the notice and opportunity to be heard has to occur before a dismissal under Rule 4? That's what I'm trying to understand.
I think if I'm following it correctly, that it's the first. I mean, it's clear that under due process, there's situations where notice can't be provided, and as long as the person who's affected by the ruling has an opportunity to contest it and correct it and offer an opportunity to correct whatever is deficient, then due process has been satisfied. In this case, Mr. Williams filed a motion for reconsideration. It was filed after his merits brief because the district court, we were on a very tight schedule for filing the merits brief and couldn't respond to the procedural default order before then. But it was the district court incorrectly applied the standard for governing final judgments, which this was not. It was an interlocutory order.
How's that true? So let's go to that order. That's a docket entry 104, I believe.
I think that's correct.
And I have that in front of me. The district court drops a footnote in there. He actually did it in a bunch of the orders because the same issue came up. I think it's footnote 2 on page 5, where he explicitly says that the district court is rejecting the argument of the government, the state, that Rule 59E, the final judgment reconsideration rule, applies. And instead, he says explicitly that Rule 54, the interlocutory reconsideration order, applies. Quote, this rule, Rule 54, gives district courts discretion to reconsider interlocutory orders. I'm looking at page 5 of docket entry 104.
I see what you're looking at, Your Honor. And the court says that in a footnote, but in actuality, what it does is it applies the standards for, if you read the body of the order, what it's doing.
I promise you I've read the whole thing, so let's go through the body. By the way, the quote I read you is not from the footnote. It's from the body of page 5. But then the court says that I'm going to look at it to see whether I made a clear error. He says, this court must decide whether petitioner has shown that there was a clear error in this court's dismissal of petitioner's claims based on the claims being insufficiently pled. In other words, it's going back to say, did I err? Right? That's at page 6. That's the body.
I beg your pardon, what's page 6 at the bottom?
It's page 6, right above the, where it says motion for reconsideration. It's the sentence right above that.
it's not limited to correcting a clear error. It does not have to be clearly erroneous for it to reconsider its prior orders. It has plenary power to review its prior orders, and it did not apply that plenary power. And then on top of that, it denied leave to appeal.
I know, but if there was no error in any decision that it made, then why would it reconsider? In other words, your argument is, and it's us here as well, which is, no, some of these are sufficiently pled. We had a sufficient fact. You're wrong, right? That's the argument you made. And he's saying, I'm going to review this for clear error, and I've reviewed it, and I don't find that it was sufficiently pled.
Let's get past that. The judge then said, I'm not going to let you amend your pleadings either.
Okay.
Period. So let's get to the end of the story.
Let's get to the amendment. So certainly under Rule 15, you have the right, there's a rule that allows you to amend if conditions are met. And what our case law says is amendment should be freely given unless one of these conditions are met, one of these exceptions are met, including dilatory tactics, undue delay, futility, and a few other exceptions.
And none of those apply in this case, Your Honor, for reasons we've set forth.
Do you agree with me that that's the law?
That is the law.
Okay. The district court here seemed to find, and correct me if I'm wrong, I know you think it's an incorrect finding, but the district court seemed to find that there was undue delay here. Do you agree?
I do not agree that there was undue delay.
Do you agree with me the district court found that?
The district court concluded that we should have known from the beginning of filing our petition that we were on notice that we should have briefed it better.
Right.
Even though the standard of practice in the area when I moved to this office and began working here was that many petitions were filed that were identical.
We'll get to the error of it. My only question to you right now is, did the district court find that there was undue delay here? Whether it's correct or not is a separate point.
I don't believe it said undue delay, but
definitely didn't use that word. You're right.
I believe it suggested or indicated that because the case had been around for 7 years, it wasn't going to allow an amendment at this juncture, even though the rules of civil procedure allow amendment even post-judgment.
Okay. So if the district court applied the rule, Rule 15, and made at least implicit finding, which I think it's fair to say he did, and I can read you the sentence, that this just came too late in the day, there was too much of a delay here in getting the amendment, how is that a due process violation if the district court gets it wrong?
Well, Your Honors, we didn't limit our request for COA to due process. The district court did not follow due process, it did not follow the rules of civil procedure, and it did not follow the habeas rules.
Counsel, we have a COA on due process, and so I'm asking you the question. How is that, whether it's error or not, how is an abuse of discretion, which is how we would review that error, translate into a due process violation?
Because there are occasions when the rights at stake are so significant that the denial of those rights amounts to a due process error, and I'm suggesting that that is what happened here. I also think the court should take into account that the court did not follow the rules of civil procedure and did not follow the habeas rules.
But it seems to, counsel, it seems to have followed Rule 15 in that it entertained the motion to amend and understood that it should be freely given, but for certain exceptions, and then found that one of those exceptions seems to apply here.
Rule 15 requires that amendments be freely given in the interest of justice. Justice and due process are integrally related. I believe that it's a due process violation that the court denied us leave to amend.
Do you have any case? I've looked, so let me know. Do you have any case where we have said or the Supreme Court has said that the failure to grant leave to amend is a due process violation?
I believe that we cited something in the briefs.
Well, I'm not sure you have a case that says it's a due process violation, but I think you have cases in your brief that say that it can be an abuse of discretion if it's not granted in the interest of justice. Is that what your cases say?
There is a case law saying it's an abuse of discretion. There's also a case from this circuit that says that the failure to give process and allow amendment is an abuse of discretion.
Is that the argument that you're making, that the failure to grant leave to amend the petition in an instance like this amounts to an abuse of discretion because of the seriousness of the case?
Amounts to a due process violation, Your Honor? Yes, a due process violation and an abuse of discretion. All those things.
Right, you're saying, as Judge Wilson was saying, I guess, that in the interest of justice, you would not want to have a due process violation, right? I mean, in other words, by doing this, it's an abuse of discretion not to grant it, or at least to deny it on the basis that it was denied. It's not in the interest of justice because it is a due process violation.
Yes, Your Honor. And this is not, a futile exercise. The claims that the court struck, several of them were very important to Mr. Williams' case. They were litigated heavily in the state habeas court. The respondent was fully aware of what those claims were. One of those is the failure to hire a prison expert. The claim that was set forth in the petition was counsel failed to seek funds for and failed to present a prison expert who could have rebutted aggravation evidence regarding the crimes that occurred while the petitioner was incarcerated, as well as provide mitigating evidence. Mr. Williams presented two prison experts in state habeas proceedings who detailed the significant abuses Mr. Williams suffered while imprisoned in youth detention centers and the notorious Alto prison, and who explained the state of mind that young men and boys incarcerated in those facilities have to develop in order to survive, and that Mr. Williams could be safely housed if he was sentenced to life in prison in Georgia. That was incredibly important evidence in this prison killing case, and yet the jury heard none of it. The state habeas court basically ignored it, and the district court wouldn't let us address it. We also argued in our petition, quote, counsel failed adequately to utilize the retained social worker to discuss petitioner's desire not to present evidence in his defense prior to the weekend before the penalty phase was set to begin. That's clearly detailing what the facts are. It's not maybe detailed in a huge amount, but it's not leaving it to guesswork what the claim is about. Early in the case, in the summer of 2002, trial counsel asked for and received funds to hire a social worker, a psychologist, and a mitigation specialist. They then sat on those grants of funding for 2 years and did nothing with them. The counsel never retained the mitigation specialist. They retained Dr. Mesh 2 months before trial and hardly used him. And they retained Jeff Youngman, the social worker, on the weekend after voir dire started and before Mr. Williams' sentencing phase began. That's the very first step investigating mitigation that was conducted. Mr. Youngman was successful in persuading Mr. Williams that he should indeed present mitigating evidence. And had he been brought in sooner, for instance, when funding was provided 2 years before, there's a good chance that Mr. Williams would have been more engaged in his own defense and the counsel would have developed a much better mitigation case before the weekend preceding the sentencing phase. Counsel also didn't request a continuance. This was another claim that was thrown out. We pled counsel unreasonably failed to request a continuance once petitioner agreed to allow a mitigation presentation. Counsel thought that the trial court judge would have granted such a request because the judge was very concerned about Mr. Williams' reluctance to present mitigation. They didn't ask for it and had no reason for that. This court explained in Surtain versus Hamlin Terrace that prior to dismissing an action on its own motion, a court must provide plaintiff with a notice of its intent to dismiss and an opportunity to respond. Federal Rule of Civil Procedure mandates that leave to amend has to be freely given. And here the district court did neither of those things. Certain, by the way, is instructive because there's a set of claims that were for which notice was given that the court allowed to have dismissed, and there were a set of claims for which no notice had been given, and it remanded the case to have those adjudicated and to give the opportunity to the petition, the complainant, to amend those pleadings.
Well, you have reserved some time for rebuttal. We have your argument, Ms.
Can I
Wetter.
Have my extra 25 seconds? I still have 28 seconds. Oh, I'm at past my time. I'm sorry. I'm not reading the right light properly. Thank you, Your Honors.
You've got some rebuttal time. We'll hear from the state, Ms. Graham.
Sorry, I'm having a hard time hearing today, so if you see me with a confused look, There's an echo, and I can't hear very well. May it please the court, my name is Sabrina Graham. I'm here on behalf of the warden and request that the court affirm the dismissal of the ineffective assistance and Brady claims. I start off with the first question presented from this court. Was there a due process violation when the court dismissed the claims? So the way that I understand a due process violation in a federal habeas case, that you have to have, there's a couple of things you need to have. They need to have a notice of what the rule says. They need to have notice of what the consequences are if they violate that rule, and they need to have the opportunity to respond. And here you had all of those things. And I'd like to point to this court's decision in Paez. Although it doesn't specifically state due process, it talks about notice and opportunity. And in that case, it says, Mr. Paez was provided ample notice and opportunity to explain why his petition was timely in his form petition, and again when he was given the opportunity to respond to the magistrate judge's report and recommendation. So there, that is binding precedent on this court, that notice and opportunity is when they first file that petition. They've got notice from Rule 2C, they've got notice from Rule 4, and then they have the opportunity there in their petition.
Was there compliance with Rule 4 here?
So you're talking about it
in a situation where the district court complies with Rule 4. Did the district court comply with Rule 4?
It did, because there is no precedent that says that the court, if the court chooses to delay the Rule 4 analysis later?
Well, that's not really my question.
Okay, I'm sorry.
You may be right. My question is, does Rule 4 require the district court to do something?
It does say prompt. Yes.
And while certainly there's wiggle room in prompt, I think we can all reasonably agree that 7 years is not prompt, right?
I would agree with that, yes, Your Honor.
But on the other hand, it wasn't 7 years. For most of that 7 years, at no point was there any indication that for 35 of these claims, there was anything wrong with the pleading of them. In fact, the state submitted a brief and apparently thought they were perfectly sufficient under the habeas rules, because although it challenged other claims, it did not challenge 35 of the ones that the district court sua sponte decided were not adequately pled. And so when you say that for 7 years he did nothing, he did not have notice for 7 years that there were deficiencies, I mean, you know, in these. Otherwise, if your argument is the rule gave him notice, then opportunity to be heard and notice would become meaningless, would it not? Because you'd never have to give anybody a second chance or tell them that you were going to dismiss their claims, because the rules say it already. Isn't that what you're arguing?
No, Judge Rosenbaum. First of all, I think your question goes to whether or not the court erred, not whether or not there's a due process violation, which are two different things. That's very different. And here, I think that if we're going to talk about error, then it was Williams who invited this error. When the warden started out in this case, we said, hey, we want an all-in-one brief. And we told the court, we'll let them do an all-in-one brief, and we'll even accept what they put in that all-in-one brief as an amendment to their petition. Rule 5 does not require the warden to say that any claim is insufficiently pled. They only have to say exhaustion, procedural default, time bars, things of that nature. We're not required to put that in answer. We gave them that opportunity to begin with. And then they invited the court to put off this Rule 4.
But here's the problem with that, right? The problem is that, you know, you all went along with it. The district court ordered it. And for 7 years, you know, there was no indication to him that these 35 claims that the district court sua sponte decided to dismiss for, you know, improper pleading, that there was anything at all wrong with the pleading. In fact, the exact opposite was the case, because while you had not challenged those claims, you had challenged 5 other claims. And I'm not saying you were trying to mislead him, don't get me wrong. The question here is whether he had notice and an opportunity to be heard. And I thought I understood your brief to argue he had notice and an opportunity to be heard because the rule said if you don't plead these specifically enough, then they will be dismissed. And I guess the thing I'm taking issue with, first of all, you can tell me if I'm misunderstanding your argument, But if I'm not misunderstanding your argument, I don't see how you could ever, there would ever be cause for having notice and an opportunity to be heard separately from what the rule says. But we know that that's not the case because the Supreme Court has told us there must be notice and an opportunity to be heard in addition to whatever the rules provide. So you see what I'm trying to ask you here?
Kind of.
Okay, well, let me take it one step at a time.
Well,
Is it your argument that the rules in and of themselves gave him notice and an opportunity to be heard?
Correct. Under this court's precedent, yes, it says
well,
that.
Well, I disagree that that's what our precedent says. But second of all, it seems to me that from a practical standpoint, the necessary consequence of what you are saying is that you would never have a problem where somebody did not receive notice and an opportunity to be heard because it would always be included in the rules as written. And so there would be no reason for the Supreme Court to hold that you must give notice and an opportunity to be heard. How do you address that?
I go back to Pius, where this court said that the rule and the petition is the notice and opportunity to be heard. The court said it again in Borden versus Allen, that the rule is notice to the petitioner of what is required.
So let's start with Borden v. Allen.
Sure, Borden, but I'd like to build it into
Let me ask you about Borden v. Allen, because you're relying on that case to disagree with a proposition I've put forward. So I want to test that a little bit, because maybe you're right, and maybe I'm missing something. So in Borden v. Allen, that was not a case about due process, was it? And
yeah.
It wasn't a case about whether the federal standard of pleading had been satisfied, was it?
There are no cases about due process.
And anything that was said in there about the federal standard of pleading is complete dicta, is it not?
That may be so, Judge Rosenbaum, but there are no cases from this court about due process or from the Supreme Court about due process regarding Rule 2C or Rule 4. Mention due process.
We do have lots of cases about notice and due process generally, notice and an opportunity to be heard, and due process more generally. And we have cases about the problems when you do sua sponte dismissals without notice and an opportunity to be heard. We have that, right?
Correct, and that's Pius, and that's in, I guess I don't understand what you're saying. In all of those cases, then the notice and the opportunity issue would be dicta because it's not dealing with due process, because in none of your cases or the Supreme Court cases, state due process.
It's not dicta because it's not dealing with due process. It's dicta because it's not necessary for the holding in the case, whatever it is you're citing it for. But in any case, the issue here with respect to whether or not there's been notice and an opportunity to be heard, it's going to get back to the point that I was asking your colleague about, and that is whether it comes before the district court dismisses under Rule 4 or afterwards in the form of allowing a motion to amend that is reviewed under the usual standards and not under the motion for reconsideration standards. Doesn't there have to be an opportunity and a notice, an opportunity to be heard and notice before it can be finally dismissed?
No. And I think, again, there's two separate questions here. The first question is, did the court violate due process in finding they were insufficiently pled? If the court had done this at the beginning of this proceeding and not after the 7 years, which again, Warden contends was invited by Williams, if the court had done it then the only thing that they could have filed was a motion for reconsideration. There is no magistrate judge, there is no report and recommendation. If the court under Rule 4 said, hey, I find these claims to be insufficiently pled and dismiss those claims, then their opportunity to be heard would be in a motion for reconsideration.
Why wouldn't it be in a motion to amend?
Because the court's already dismissed the claims, so they would have to ask, as they did in this case, a motion for reconsideration.
You're saying if judgment were entered. You're saying if judgment were entered, that would be the case.
Just like it, I guess I don't understand, but in this case, the court dismissed those claims when it did its review, and they filed a motion for reconsideration, And a request to amend.
Was that motion for reconsideration filed before or after the district court entered judgment in the case?
After the court entered judgment.
Okay, so the point is that I'm making is at some point in the process, there would have had to have been an opportunity, assuming that the due process case law applies here, and I don't understand why it wouldn't, there would have had to have been an opportunity for the district, for Mr. Williams to have had notice of the deficiency and an opportunity to be heard. And so that would mean he would have to have at least one opportunity to try to amend.
And my answer to
the normal standards. I mean, other courts, our sister circuits, have said that you can't look at the motion for you can't look at it under the motion for reconsideration standards. You have to look at it under the normal motion to amend standards.
I am not aware of any binding precedent from this court, and there's also precedent from the Sixth Circuit that says differently that we cited in our brief. But back to my original point, if the court in the beginning under Rule 4 had said, I'm dismissing these claims as insufficiently pled, their only response to that at the beginning would be a motion for reconsideration and a request to amend within that motion for reconsideration. They were in the same place at the beginning as they were 7 years later. So you can't have a due process violation if you're going to be in the same place arguing the same thing.
Well, I don't think that's right. I mean, you can have a due process violation the first day a case is in process, or you can have it, you know, 10 years later. When it occurs doesn't mean that it's not a due process violation. It's what is the process that has occurred before the dismissal.
And that's saying the process is the same in the beginning as it was 7 years later. I'm not saying that the time frame makes a difference. What I'm saying is that under Rule 4,
right,
the court had the authority to dismiss those claims at the very beginning.
Provide an opportunity. It had to provide notice and an opportunity to be heard. In other words, it couldn't just go ahead and dismiss all of the claims and then refuse to consider whether he could amend it in such a way that he could bring at least one time. Granted, there's a limit to it, but at least one time, it couldn't refuse to consider whether he could amend it sufficiently to state a claim. Would you agree with that? Or is it your position that just, and I think it is because I think this is what you've said, that any district court on day one, if it wanted to, could sua sponte dismiss a petitioner's claims for failure to comply with the pleading standard and provide no opportunity to replead? That's what your position is, right? Is that your position? That's what I'm trying to find out.
Yes, they can.
That is what is a problem,
I
think.
Yeah.
How does that provide due process? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Paya says that's the notice of opportunity.
That's not what Paya says.
It specifically says that, and this court has repeated that language over and over again in its cases where it said the notice provided ample notice and opportunity to explain why his petition was timely in his form petition. So that was it. That's the notice and opportunity. Because what you're looking at there is a court that has found it to be untimely, and this court is saying that timely decision that was dismissed. Well,
let me ask the question this way. I'm trying to determine what the state's position is. Is the state's position that pursuant to Rule 4, you're not entitled to due process? Rule 4 deprives you of due process? Or is the state's position that he received due process? Which of the two is it?
No, you've received due process. According to this court's precedent, because you have notice of the rule and you have notice of the consequences of the rule, you had the opportunity to fill out your petition in compliance with the rule. That's notice and opportunity,
so
you're that's
entitled,
due process.
He's entitled to due process, and the state's position is he received it here because Rule 4 gives him notice. And how does Rule 4 give him an opportunity to be heard?
With the petition.
What do you mean?
I mean, that's what Paya says. It says notice an opportunity to explain why his petition was timely in his form petition.
I can understand how Rule 4 gives you notice, but what I'm trying to figure out is how Rule 4 gives you an opportunity to be heard before the court dismisses your petition.
But you get it in your petition. You get your opportunity there to be heard in your petition. That's the due process. There isn't any precedent out there that
says
you've
already filed your petition. The petition is insufficient. The court looks at Rule 4. The court says this petition is insufficient. I'm dismissing it. The petitioner knows that Rule 4 gives the court the opportunity to dismiss it. But how does he have an opportunity to be heard before the court dismisses the petition?
There isn't any precedent that says the court has to come along after Rule 4 and give them another opportunity to be heard about their petition under due process.
Yeah.
Now, is it error? Isn't, that's a different question. But due process, there isn't any precedent on that.
Isn't the normal procedure for the district court to issue an order to show cause?
Yes.
And that did not take place here, did it?
Because petitioner asked the court, hey, we want this protracted briefing schedule where we can find new facts to amend our petition. They told the court, Williams told the court, I want to amend after briefing on the evidentiary hearing. They didn't ask for leave to amend even after they got new facts. So, and then when we got to the part of procedural default, we put them on notice again. Hey, look. Here, this is a Rule 2 error. Now,
I fully agree that you put them on notice with respect to the five claims that were dismissed that you also said were insufficiently pled. I completely agree with you on that. There is notice. He had an opportunity to be heard. You told him what was wrong with it. My problem is with the other 35 that you said were okay. That meets the pleading standard. We're not challenging it on that basis. And then the district court, of its own accord, and without any warning of any type, went ahead and dismissed. Those are the claims that at least I am concerned about.
I understand, Judge Rosenbaum. But here, first of all, the court didn't have to give him notice of that. The court didn't have to give him notice at the beginning. It didn't have to give him notice then. And
it didn't have to do that. But what do we do with the Supreme Court's decision in Day versus McDonough? This is a 2006 opinion, and it says the court must act promptly pursuant to Rule 4, but the Supreme Court does say that the petitioner must be afforded fair notice and an opportunity to be heard, right?
I understand what Day says, but again, Day does not mention due process. That is not, there's no mention whatsoever in there of due process. And again, if you want to say
that
what due
process, isn't that what due process is? Notice and an opportunity to be heard?
Well, notice and opportunity to be heard could come under many different rules and not necessarily rise to the level of a due process violation. And even this court has said that it doesn't always mean that you get a hearing or whatever it may be under due process, as long as you're told what the requirement is and you're told what the consequences are for not meeting
it. All he wants is another opportunity to amend his petition here.
That's the second question, correct?
I understand that. That's a separate question. And he was denied leave to amend. And, I mean, this is a pretty significant case. We've got precedent, clear precedent in the 11th Circuit, where we say that if a more carefully crafted pleading is possible, a court should give at least one chance. He was not given one chance, was he?
He was not given one chance, but that's a question of error, not a question of due process. The question
asking about due process then.
Okay.
I'm asking whether or not the court abused its discretion by denying him an opportunity to have one shot to amend his petition in a pretty significant case. And no, why doesn't that constitute an abuse of discretion?
It's not an abuse of discretion because there's more to that analysis that the district court can do. And part of what Judge Luck said, the court implied, look, this is undue delay. You've had all this time. You've had 7 years. You could have amended. They could have amended after they got new facts, and they still didn't do it. The court obviously put off that Rule 4 decision because they told him they were going to get new facts. They told him they wanted to get new facts, and they wanted to amend their petition, and then they didn't do it. And then when they reminded of that, which when the warden reminded him, although I understand we only said the 10 claims and five of which the court found, but those claims, That was not an affirmative defense. That put them on notice that the court could be going back to do its Rule 4 analysis.
So how much time expired between the dismissal of his petition and his motion for leave to amend?
So he didn't dismiss, you mean the dismissal of the claims? So that was several months before they filed the motion for reconsideration. I believe it was 3 to 4 months before they filed the motion for reconsideration.
And that's undue delay?
No, the court wasn't saying the motion for reconsideration was the undue delay. The court was saying, you told me in the beginning of this proceeding that you wanted to find more facts and that you wanted to amend at a later date after we have briefed, after the issue of evidentiary hearing was decided, but then you didn't do it.
Yeah, but that was all that time expired before he knew that the court was going to dismiss his claims.
But he was still on notice of the rule, and he had told the court, again, telling the court,
he knew of the rules, but he did not know that the court was going to dismiss his claims, right?
I don't think any petitioner, if you say it that way, then that means no petitioner knows it until the court does something. But they do know it because they have notice of the rules.
Yeah, that's why the court normally employs an order to show cause. And that keeps the court out of trouble, and it also provides the petitioner notice and an opportunity to be heard. And that did not take place in this case.
But it did. It did at the beginning. And again, they invited the court not to do the show cause order. They invited the court to enter a protracted scheduling order so that they could go and find new facts to amend their petition. So why would the court do that at the beginning if it was going to have to do it again later on? They invited this delay in the court doing its Rule 4 analysis. But regardless, back to the due process regarding amendment. So because I'm sorry, I got off topic there. back to the amendment. On due process for the amendment, the court has said, the district court said undue delay, and sort of built into that was the dilatory tactics. And that is a reason for the court to say, I'm not going to allow you to amend.
Can it only be dilatory if you know that you're doing it to delay? Like, and how can you know that you're doing it to delay if you don't know that your pleading is deficient in the first place, because even the state didn't know that the pleading was deficient?
Well, the state didn't have to say that the pleading was deficient.
I agree, the state didn't have to, but it chose to say that other parts of the claims were deficient, and it did not choose to say that 35 of them were, which at least to me suggests that, I mean, I don't know why the state would decide if it thought some of the claims were, if it thought all the claims were deficient, to just pick out some of them and say, and make that as their argument. I mean, that doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Well, I think in looking at their petition, what the warden did, since I was the person who wrote that brief, anything in there whatsoever I could give them the benefit of the doubt on pleading, I did. And I didn't apply the fact pleading the same way that the court did.
You're an accomplished attorney. You're here arguing this case before the 11th Circuit. You represent the state regularly in these kinds of things. And you didn't think that, I mean, granted, you might have wanted to give them the benefit of the doubt, but you didn't think there was enough to make a good enough argument to ask the court to dismiss it. So how is he supposed to know?
How is who supposed to know?
Williams.
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
It'd have been more clear.
I thought you're sorry. Because attorneys can disagree, no matter how long you've practiced at something, you can disagree. I mean, he didn't have to agree with me, and that's what he says in his brief.
But isn't that the whole reason why we require the court to give notice and an opportunity to be heard? Because it's not like it's a black and white standard, right? I mean, we all know there are some judges who might apply it more strictly than other judges. And, you know, it's a very difficult thing. It's not like you write a complaint and you say, oh, this definitely meets the standard, and you're going to be right. I mean, there are lots and lots and lots of attorneys who write complaints only to find out that it didn't meet the standard, and have it dismissed. I mean, that happens all the time. And, I mean, it just seems like an awful lot to ask of someone.
But they had their opportunity to be heard in their motion for reconsider. If the court doesn't think that the rule at the beginning or the warden saying these aren't, they had their opportunity in the motion for reconsideration. As Judge Luck stated, when the court went back and it evaluated their motion for reconsideration as to whether or not the claims were sufficiently pled, the court said, I'm just going to go back and look at these claims again. So he just went back and looked to see if they were sufficiently pled, and he said, they're not sufficiently pled. They hadn't given much of an argument showing that they were sufficiently pled. So there, on the first part, you clearly have due process. On the amendment, you also have due process. They had all of the facts.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Let's just say this was regular litigation. Let's take this outside the concept of ADEPA and habeas rules and all that. So this is a federal slip and fall case.
Okay.
Just let's assume it's in federal court because of some sort of diversity jurisdiction. And someone tries to allege in the complaint that there was a slip and fall, it was the negligence of a party, and they were damaged as a result, and it was caused by that party's negligence. The district court, after a motion to dismiss, says, I don't think so, and dismisses it. And imagine in my hypothetical that Rule 15 did not exist. There's no way to amend. Would that system, would that process would be a violation of the Constitution if Rule 15 didn't exist?
I can't say that it would be a violation of the Constitution.
How would you correct the error in that case?
It would be a violation of the rules, though, I think, in civil court, because it says...
Well, I'm saying, imagine the amendment rule doesn't exist. In other words, there was a motion, it was pled, there was a motion to dismiss under Rule 12b-6, and the district court says, I agree, it's insufficiently pled.
But this court's precedent says that in non-habeas cases, that a court can't sua sponte dismiss a claim on the merits.
It's not sua sponte. There's a motion to dismiss by the defendant there. So the district court says, done. And Rule 15 doesn't exist. There's no basis to amend. Is there a way to correct that error, if assuming it's error?
You could file a motion for reconsideration.
Sure, and then deny. What happens after that? An enterprising attorney do where a district court has error?
Then they would file an appeal?
They file a notice of appeal, and we could correct it, right?
Correct.
In other words, the system doesn't need amendment. In other words, it's great to have it. There are rules there. We should follow those rules. It exists. But is that a necessary predicate for due process, if such that without it, the entire constitutional structure of civil litigation would fall on its face?
No, it would not.
So let me ask you this. Does anybody get killed by the state when a case gets dismissed that's a civil case? It's a slip and fall.
I mean, there could be a civil case where they didn't have money to take care of the person and they died, certainly, yeah.
And the state is the one that carries out the death.
Whatever the punishment is that a jury has decided that they have earned is not the analysis for due process. Justice and due process are two different things.
I agree.
Yeah.
However, if we're talking about due process before there's deprivation of life, which is what we are talking about, I mean, it seems to me like that's something that you have to think about.
Time bar wouldn't exist, because if your claims are time barred...
Well, because the time bar is quite different, right? The time bar is black and white. Anybody can understand that, you know, how long a year is or whatever the time bar may be that's relevant to a given case. But as we've previously discussed, with pleading, it's really not black and white. I mean, one lawyer might think that it satisfies the standard. In fact, one judge might think it satisfies the standard, and another one might think it does not. And so that's the reason that there is notice and an opportunity to be heard. Once. Granted, there's not a requirement beyond once, but one time.
I don't think that time bar is, to me, I don't understand your black and white concept there, because what you're saying is that some things are so important they should be decided because the state is going to carry out a lawful death sentence. Whereas if it's a time bar, it's the same thing is going to happen. You're not going to get your claims looked at.
No, it's a different thing. There's due process. I'm sorry, I'll be done in just a second. There's due process in giving a black and white rule that anybody knows whether they're in compliance with. In that case, I agree with you. The rule itself, that is the notice. But when you have a rule that is a little bit subjective, I mean, yes, it's an objective standard, but as we've discussed, different people might have a slightly stricter interpretation of it than others, then the due process comes in putting someone on notice. Look, I don't think this complies with the standard. That's the difference, right? That's where the due process comes. And the reason that the due process is different in the different situations is because they are different situations. One in and of itself provides the notice. The other one does not necessarily do so.
Well, I would disagree, because then under your analysis, that would make Rule 4 in and of itself a due process violation, because you're not always going to have a black and white answer there. That's my answer to that. And I see that my time is up. Again, we respectfully ask that you affirm the dismissal of the claims. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. Ms. Witter.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me get right to it, because I have several things I'd like to bring up. Judge Luck, I said that I thought we had cited something in our briefs. In the reply brief, we cite Lindley versus City of Birmingham, in which this court said, quote, a district court must afford a plaintiff due process before dismissing a complaint sua sponte, ellipses. In other words, there must be adequate notice and an opportunity to be heard.
I think I was asking about amendment, not that. There's certainly, that is the case with regard to dismissal. My question was, have we ever said that the failure to give an amendment is a due process violation? And that was what I said, that I had never seen that case and I didn't notice it there. But I appreciate it. I have your briefs. I've read them carefully, and I'm going to pour through them to try to find that case, okay?
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. Then the state relies on Paez.
What was that case again?
Lindley. Hold on, let me find it again. Lindley versus City of Birmingham. It's an unpublished case at 452 Federal Appendix 878. The quote is at page 880. The state relies on Paez as...
Do you have any published cases to support that
proposition? It cites a published case, which is...
Is it an 11th Circuit published case?
Tazzo versus Airbus SAS 631 Federal 3rd at 1321. Pinpoint site is 1336. It's an 11th Circuit case from 2011. Paez is a case the state relies on for the proposition that just the existence of rules places a petitioner on notice. But in Paez, the petitioner, in fact, got actual notice because there was a magistrate who reviewed his petition. He issued a report and recommendation. The petitioner had an opportunity to respond to the report and recommendation.
He filed objections, right?
I can't remember if he filed objections. He might have filed objections. But regardless, he had the opportunity to file objections. The state also makes a big deal about the scheduling order that the court granted us. In the state's own motion for an order, it recognized that Mr. Williams would have the opportunity, quote, to brief the issues or amend the issues within his final brief, recognizing what the rules permit, which is amendment of pleadings through the briefing process.
Well, I mean, that's my concern, too. You say the state makes that argument. There was a seven-year period of time within which Mr. Williams had to fix the deficiencies in his petition. There's some diligence requirement.
Well, Your Honor, we also asked for an opportunity to have in the scheduling order an opportunity to amend the petition, but the district court did not put that in its scheduling order. Instead, it created a 45-day deadline from the time of
the... Isn't that the purpose of the scheduling order, though, is to... He asked for it, and that the purpose to give him an opportunity to make sure that his petition was sufficient?
We wanted to develop evidence that had not been developed in state court, which we did partially because we discovered a Brady violation that had been submitted to the state habeas court, but not to us years before, and it was disclosed to us only in federal court. And when we sought to develop that claim further, we were not given the opportunity to.
But the scheduling order was for the purpose of correcting the procedural irregularities, not the merits of the petition, right?
The scheduling order provided that discovery and a motion for an evidentiary hearing could be addressed prior to addressing procedural default rulings. It's a very standard order in these cases, and the procedural default ruling was briefing was supposed to address procedural default causing prejudice and nothing else. It was not even stated that it was to address the sufficiency of the pleadings. In any event,
So let me ask another question, though, before your time runs out. How many of his claims were not dismissed? How many of his claims survived? There were just five claims that were dismissed, right?
There were 61 ineffective assistance of counsel subclaims. The court took the remaining 20 and consolidated them into two claims that it said we could address, but then it, in the end, ultimately only allowed us to address the first claim.
But the claims that were not dismissed were briefed.
They were briefed, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, and he had an opportunity to brief those.
Yes, we're not complaining about that. We asked for a COA to address issues relating to the district court's disposition of the merits, but you did not grant that.
Okay.
I thank Your Honor for bringing up Day versus McDonough, which I was going to bring up, but I do want to point out that the state made a big point about how these timeliness cases allow the court to just dismiss a case that's untimely, but that's in fact not true. Day versus McDonough says, quote, "Of course, before acting on its own initiative, a court must accord the parties fair notice and an opportunity to present their positions."
But Day's a bit different procedurally. In Day, the state stipulated there, and what the court did there is said, I don't care what the state said, I'm going to rule on timeliness on my own. And what the Supreme Court said there is, yes, the court can do that under very narrow circumstances. Could it reject a stipulation by the state? That's very different than what we have here.
I don't think the notice and opportunity to object has anything to do with what the procedural posture of that case was. I think it's just a basic due process requirement. And the court certainly didn't say that that was what it was about. It just said that if a court's going to do it sua sponte, they have to give notice. And of course, if the state were to have objected to timeliness, that would have been notice.
The whole point of Day was that the state had stipulated and the district court did it anyway, despite that. And the question was, under what circumstances there would it afford, I don't think due process was used, but what procedural rights were they entitled to? And the court there said that in those circumstances, it's required to this and that. In other words, it has to have notice the court is considering doing something that the state explicitly said it was not asking for and did not want it to do.
But had the state not explicitly said it was accepting it as timely, had it instead said it is untimely, that act would have given the petitioner notice that timeliness was an issue. So he would have gotten notice regardless of which way it went.
And so with regard to your claim that he was denied leave to amend, is it my understanding that your argument is that that was an abuse of discretion? That's not really a violation of due process, is it?
Your Honor, the court has cabined us into a due process claim, although there's no reason for that. This is not a habeas claim. It doesn't need to violate the Constitution in order to be a reversible error. And I encourage the court to amend the COA to encompass the rules of civil procedure and the rules governing habeas petitions to the extent the court does not find that they themselves are due process components. If I may have a few seconds to wrap up. The district court violated the habeas rules, the rules of civil procedure and due process in dismissing multiple claims without providing meaningful notice and an opportunity to defend against or cure any deficiency. It did this in the context of Mr. Williams' first and likely only federal habeas petition, a particularly serious matter as the United States Supreme Court recognized in Lonchar versus Thomas. As a result of this error, Mr. Williams' ineffective assistance of counsel claim did not receive the cumulative assessment that Strickland demands, and Mr. Williams was unable to pursue claims regarding the government's misconduct in suppressing favorable evidence and presenting false testimony. Mr. Williams asked the court to remand this matter to the district court to allow him to amend his pleadings and to allow the court to hear his ineffective assistance claim in its entirety, as Strickland requires, as well as his amended Brady and NAPU claims. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Witter and Ms. Graham. Court is in recess until 3:30 this afternoon.
All right.